No. Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and having some sort of inner crisis on the other side of this conversation is James. Before we get started, I want to get you to check out our website, themacguffinman.com. We've done a lot of content on one-word titles recently. Interstellar, Nightcrawler, Memento, Vertigo. And before that, we had The Silence of the Lambs. Also follow us on Twitter, at The MacGuffin Man. And tell all your friends about us. Tell anybody that listens to podcasts about us. Tell other people that don't listen to podcasts. Anyway, we've botched this, so let's just get right to the episode.
We don't have an actor. And if we cancel the first preview, the press is going to smell blood. And we can't afford to lose any more money at all.
Okay, what do you think I should do?
Well, we hired an understudy. Let's use the understudy.
Yeah.
Regan, listen to me. Please, for the love of God, listen. Our perfect dream actor is not going to knock on that door and go, hey, fellas, when do I start, you know?
Can I talk to you for a second?
Yeah, what's up?
Did you find another actor?
No.
Okay, well, Mike's available.
He is?
Mm-hmm. Mike who?
I thought he was doing the thing.
He quit. Or got fired.
Mike who? Which is it, quit or fired?
Well, with the Mike, it's usually both.
Mike fucking who?
Shiner.
Yes!
Jake.
Oh my gosh, how do you know Mike Shiner?
We share a vagina.
You think he'd want to do it?
Mm-hmm.
How do you know?
Because he told me he wanted to do it.
Jake, yes. Ask me if he sells tickets.
Fine, does he sell tickets?
He sells a shitload of tickets. Okay. Now ask me if the theater critics love him.
The theater critics love him.
They want to spooge on him.
Hey.
Leslie?
Right on his face.
Everything for a reason, right?
You think he'd come in this evening?
I'll call him and find out.
I'll call his agent.
James.
Yo.
That's a new one.
Yep.
Like 198 episodes in and we're spicing it up. We're
what are we doing for 200?
I have no idea. Probably just any other podcast.
Okay.
We'll do it on Varsity Blues again, because I don't think we really got to the heart of that movie.
We've talked about too many good movies in a row, so.
Yeah, it's been a good fall. We need to go back to the hot days of late August when we were talking about garbage films.
Is the new Twilight out yet?
I don't think you understand how that series works.
Probably not. Okay, one more real movie?
Yeah.
Okay, which one?
Birdman, right?
Oh. Yeah, but this is no one-word title.
Ugh. Are we getting right into that?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, I hate the subtitle. I think it's so stupid.
That there's a subtitle or this subtitle?
This subtitle specifically. But yeah, I like if you title your movie something or then it's just idiotic because it only makes anybody ever think of Dr. Strangelove, you know? Like, it's just, it's not a good way to start your film by being like, hey, remember that Stanley Kubrick movie that's really impossible to be better than? let's remind everybody of that right off the top.
Yeah, and overall, I like this movie. It has a little bit of, I'm going to say, overreaching at times.
Okay, yeah. I think I would say it a lot of times.
Yeah, and the subtitle just drives that point home. Like, it's so much polysyllabic, deep-sounding words.
And the parentheses just put it over the top. Yeah. Just, and like, in the title card of the movie, it's Birdman, and then or, not in parentheses, and then the unexpected virtue of ignorance in parentheses, which makes no grammatical sense at all.
No, it's that part's silly and just like so much of this movie is just summed up in that title. Like it's this cool little small little meta thing that you know, obviously talks about Batman and superhero movies since then. Mm-hmm. And then it's just this injection of pretentious subtitle, and that's I don't know, I find that sums it up pretty well.
Yeah, exactly.
So you agree with my overreaching?
Oh yeah.
Overall, how do you feel about it?
It's enjoyable, but it, okay, the best way I can describe this movie is to say that it's a movie that lacks confidence. I like the way that I feel this movie was structured in pre-production and the writing stage was people would come up with ideas, but those ideas would always be punctuated by them asking, right? Like, people like long takes, right? People are tired of superhero movies, right? Like, they never really know what they're trying to say. They want to double check with everybody before they sort of put it out there, you know?
Yeah. Well, I've got the perfect title for this movie, Birdman, or...
People love weird subtitles, right? People like Dr. Strangelove, right? Let's make our title like that.
Yeah, see, I see what you mean, but that's really not how I would diagnose what I find to be wrong with this movie, because I think it has a ton of confidence. I just don't think it needs to be as confident as it is in some of the ideas. But I guess I agree with you because, or at least in the sense that I feel like there's parts of a really good movie here, and then there'll be a few minutes at a time of just, here's one more idea. And it never really gets any traction.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get back to things that actually function properly as a good movie.
Like, what's an example?
The two actresses kissing for a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know. To me, that was just like, here's some depth. And, you know, you didn't predict this. And this is kind of edgy and New York-y, right? And it's just like, oh, that added nothing. Okay.
Yeah.
Like, those characters aren't that fleshed out. So I think it was just like, hey, let's give them some screen time. Here's one more thing about these people. Now that's a fully three-dimensional character, right?
Yeah, exactly.
No, that is not correct. There's a couple things like that. It's, you know, that certainly isn't the only one, but I felt like there are some really, really cool ideas in here. We'll certainly talk more about it. Technically, it's a very, very impressive movie to watch. but... Yeah, I think there is a lot of good stuff in here, and then a lot of extra stuff that I think they thought, hey, we'll put it close to good stuff and it'll pass. it does not, at least not to me.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have taken your subjective opinion and turned it into objective fact. Welcome to new media, everybody.
Yeah, critics just label stuff.
I'm going to be the Tabitha of this podcast.
You already are.
Yeah, that's probably true.
So what was good about
it? And I do look like I just licked a homeless man's asshole or whatever that was.
What did this movie do well for you then?
Well, I mean, like you said, quite gorgeous. Quite a gorgeous film.
Yeah, the whole one take thing? Or even beyond that?
Mostly just because the images were pretty. And, I mean, Emmanuel Lubezki is Terrence Malick's cinematographer, which is like a life pass for me. It's just anytime he is shooting something, it's gonna look pretty. And this movie looks exceptionally pretty. And yeah, the idea of doing it all in one, you know, faux long take is nice. And I certainly enjoy the idea and the execution of that for the most part. I don't know. It's just such a pretty movie to look at. And the fact that like Lubezki's cameras typically tend to do, there's just sort of the steady cam gliding through the scene all the time. And it's not really a strong, hard movement or anything, but you know, you normally get some sort of floating of the camera, even if it's just very mild, you know, and there's just a lot of really nice wide angle shots of people standing right in front of a camera, you know, which I don't know. He makes simple things look really, really gorgeous. Yeah.
Yeah. And like in reading the reviews and talking to people about this movie, the one long take or the faux one long take, as you described it more accurately, is really the only visual thing I hear about. But I remember you and I first saw this trailer. It looked amazing. Like,
yeah.
You had no idea I had no idea that they were going to shoot it this way with these really long takes. But just the images of themselves, just that, you know, for a few seconds at a time, looked really nice. And I think this does look better. I think a lot of people are really focusing on that one element of the visuals and kind of selling the movie short from a visual standpoint.
Yeah, and there's a lot of mixing of light sources in this movie, which is normally a bad sign. But in this movie, it's really great. Like, it's not... It's not mixing just to make things look interesting. It's it, there's just sort of a, there's, it seems like it's fully thought out. Like a lot of those Bruckheimer movies in the early 2000s, like Gone in 60 Seconds is a good example of this. There's just like a purple light in the corner of a room for no reason other than to just add some visual flair to the yellow and the orange lights that are in other places in the room, you know? Yeah. And this, I don't know, it always looked gorgeous. Like Michael Keaton, when he was lit blue, looked just as gorgeous as when he was lit in natural lighting, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And that's what happens when you have a genius as your DOP.
Yeah, and he won last year for Gravity, right?
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, that's a movie that, you know, you'd think would beg for a very interesting cinematographer and a lot of very interesting technical work, just because, you know, it's in space and there's, you know, there's action sequences in that movie and just, you know, space can be shot very gorgeously, as we've seen in a lot of movies.
Mm-hmm.
this movie, like on paper, really wouldn't, like, I wouldn't think would necessitate this kind of shooting style, but it really is very effective.
Yes. You mean sort of the, yeah, the, I think the idea of the long take is that, I mean, we get, I mentioned Terrence Malick already, and we'll mention him in every podcast we do for the rest of our lives, but...
including Varsity Blues Part 2.
Coming next week. you totally threw me. Oh, the very beginning shots before we sort of engage in this long take of the, I don't know, evolution and... the Big Bang or whatever we're seeing at the comet falling to the earth.
Yeah.
Those are very, those made me think immediately of The Tree of Life, Terrence Malick movie, which again reaches for the stars. And I think the idea of the long take in this movie isn't even just to get us Riggins' perspective, like the Michael Keaton perspective, because we see scenes that he's not in at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea is to sort of show what I said with like that gliding steady cam, that there's just sort of this viewer that is going through all of these things that are in some way connected to each other. Like there's never a break. All of these things that we see are linked together in the way the universe is, you know, and that's, yeah. That's kind of a thing I didn't like about the movie. Like I love the long take idea. And then what it seems to be trying to get across wasn't my favorite. And when the long take does eventually break at the end, it's to get us back to those Terrence Malick imagery, Terrence Malick imagery. Right?
Yeah. I kind of thought the long take thing works really well for a movie about Broadway or just a movie about theater in general.
Yes, I agree with that part of it.
Yeah, because I mean the thing that's so impressive when you go and see, you know, a live performance of something like this of a play or something is that, you know, everyone knows their lines so well for hours and hits all their marks and remembers everything. And you know, to do that over and over, to memorize everything and all your cues and beats and movements and blocking and things like that. That's what makes dramatic actors, like stage actors, much more respected than screen actors in general. And so you do get that. You know, you get these scenes where, you know, as we said, there are cuts in this movie that are usually well hidden. But then there's also just, you know, 10, 15 minutes of a time at a time that are just, you know, one take, like one performance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a very honest way to do a movie about theater, I think, like to really have these people, some of which, you know, like Edward Norton and people who are known to be very good stage actors as well. I just thought that was a good way to leech a bit of that credibility, I guess. but I mean, done so in an honest way, like these are engaging performances. I thought Ed Norton is fantastic in this movie.
Oh, Ed Norton's wonderful in this movie.
Yeah, he's a good actor in general, but even this time I was kind of pleasantly surprised by how good he can be.
Yeah.
You know, so we get the best of both worlds, though. We get, you know, as I said, we get these engaging dialogue heavy scenes that are just really, you know, raw and emotional and just characters being played well by actors.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get some of the better stuff from cinema and from the world of film, and the you know, the long take stuff we were talking about, this technical prowess, just the insane amount of preparation and choreography and craftsmanship that goes into putting together a movie like this. You know, you get that cool side of film.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, in theater, you can't have that much fun with visuals. I think this movie has a ton of fun, and I haven't seen, I don't think, any other of Inarritu's movies. But
none of them are like this.
Well, that's what I, from what I understand, none of them are fun.
yeah, you know. Fun isn't fun. He is not the auteur of fun, despite the fact that seemingly every picture ever taken of him has him mid laugh.
Yeah, I know. But I'm just, I mean, I just looked over his career, and it's, you know, movies about human trafficking and other very unpleasant subjects. And there's unpleasantness in this movie, certainly. And we're dealing with themes like, you know, fading from fame and having a broken relationship with your daughter and kind of regretting 2 decades of your life and feeling like your artistic work worth is not really worth anything anymore. But
divorce, alcoholism.
Divorce, alcoholism. Yeah, there's impotence. There's tons of fun in this movie, though. Like, it's, there are a lot of very, very good laughs. And you know, Edward Norton again doing this thing where he just can absolutely nail a dramatic performance while being hilarious, and I was very happy with that. But yeah, it, like as I did say before, I do think that at times it tries to be more than it is and tries to be very deep and kind of just, you know, get a hold of so many ideas to look like there's a lot going on, and there is some stuff going on, but I don't think as much as they want you to believe.
Oh, no.
This is a movie that very explicitly talks about critics in the media and pop culture.
Yes.
Which are themes you seem to find in any movie.
Certainly the latter. I don't know if I find the theme of criticism in any movie. I am willing to inject my own criticism into any film, but...
Okay, but those are, just to say that those are some of your
things I think about culture. Yes. And criticism. Yes, that is. Yes. Absolutely correct.
How do you feel this movie did with them?
I thought the pretty much any time, or not any time, because there are a couple good jokes in there, but I felt the way that this movie talked about the modern cinema landscape very annoying. Like the whole he's an Avenger, ugh, they got him too, they put him in a cape, and like that whole sequence where they're just listing actors that are superheroes, he's watching Robert Downey Jr. on television talking about the Avengers or whatever.
Fassbender.
Yeah, exactly. There are some fun jokes in there, but sort of the end point of the stuff about superheroes is just kind of, I don't know, I just kind of rolled my eyes a bit at it, you know?
Like, what's the perceived endpoint?
Sorry, not endpoint, but just sort of the whole, it was like, what, like I said, it's like, aren't superhero movies bad, right? You know, like it was that vibe again. It didn't really feel like it was adding anything new to a thing I already was aware of, you know?
Yeah, did this seem a little bit...
Yes, whatever you're going to ask, the answer is yes.
You're sensing a negative tone in my voice and fully agreeing.
Buy me another martini, sir.
Yeah. No, like, did you get the vibe it was a bit, like, defensive on the part of the filmmaker and kind of self-righteous, like... very critical of critics, all the kind of artists risk everything, critics risk nothing.
Yes.
Yeah. Like,
there's a lot of what we have talked about in the past, old man yelling in this film, I think. about superheroes, there was that. About social media, there was a lot of that. And about criticism, yes, there is that. And there are lines in this movie where Regan is talking to Tabitha and putting down her occupation, like, critics do nothing, and like, to an extent, like, I always understand where he's coming from, and to an extent I think he's right, but I also sort of think that criticism definitely has more value than this movie says it does, because I think, like, in order for and I mean, maybe that's sort of the problem of the movie, but in order for a work to kind of continue to exist over a number of years, like, say, Inarritu's previous film, Beautiful, isn't very good. And it's not going to be remembered 10 years from now because there's going to be no vocal person that wants it to be remembered. Whereas, say, Mike Nichols died today. The Graduate is a movie that will be remembered forever because it keeps getting people to talk about it because people see it, remember it, and have a voice to talk about it. And critics love The Graduate. So that's how that movie's legacy is able to continue in part, you know? And so I think there's a bit more of a relationship between art and criticism than I think this movie agrees with. But I certainly see all of Reagan's points, you know? Because, yes, yeah. Well, I mean, like, what we're doing now, talking about a movie, is much less involved than making this movie, you know?
Yeah.
We made way fewer decisions.
But way better decisions.
That's supposed to be something I say, James.
Right. No, and I think that's what I was going to say. I think you agree with a lot of the points that are being made. It's just the delivery, or?
Yeah, yeah, to an extent. Like, just the whole the artist is quote unquote risking more because it's more embarrassing if to fail on stage than it is to write a review that nobody reads, you know, as speaking from experience, you know?
As someone who's written many reviews, nobody's read.
My coherence review really changed the game.
Yeah. Yeah. Like there's that quote that he has on his mirror, right. In his dressing room there. And you see it very early on in the movie, and it says a thing is a thing, not what is said of that thing.
Yeah.
And you know, I just immediately I thought this is Reagan's talking, and maybe, you know, critics or you know, just culture in general has really gotten down on this guy over the past 20 years, and that's kind of something he tells himself, like, you know, don't listen to that. You mm-hmm. you have true value. And as this movie progressed, it just felt more and more like the filmmaker saying, like, oh, anyone who's ever said anything bad about my movies is wrong.
Yeah.
Like, it just got a lot more personal in the worst sense of the word. Like, yeah. just a lot more self-centered and, like, needlessly aggressive. I mean, he must have obviously has dealt with way more stuff, as we just discussed, about being an artist versus doing what we do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just seemed really immature to me, like more and more immature as the movie went on. Like that quote, which I thought at first, you know, could be meaningful. It's not that profound, but I can see how it could be self-affirming for someone with such a public career.
Yeah.
As Reagan's would have had in this movie. Mm-hmm. But just as things progressed, it just seemed less and less about Reagan's than it did about these filmmakers in particular.
Yeah. I think the main thing that really bothers me about that is that it kind of it totally ignores what I think is like the key thing to understand anytime you create anything, is that the second you finish it and like release it to the world, you stop having any control over what it's actually about, you know? Like it can be about what it is to you, but the people that are going to see it are going to have their readings of it, and you're kind of just mad that these people have a voice more than anything. And it's just kind of, just missing, I think the crux of making a piece of art and releasing it to the world is that you don't get to control how everybody perceives this movie, you know?
Yeah. And it's,
you don't get to control how anybody perceives it.
No. And so much of your appreciation of a thing is what you bring to it and what you're willing to see from your own life in it and what you, you know, what you can inject into these stories and have them be relevant to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's just some stuff like when they're talking about, you know, the superhero movies just as cartoons and pornography mm-hmm. and, you know, the things we discussed before, like, oh, they got him in a cape too. Like, I feel like that's kind of a media criticism that you agree with, though.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I just don't think it's something I already knew, have thought about, and it didn't make me think about it in any sort of new way. And generally, if a movie just says a view I already have and doesn't add anything new to it, it makes me roll my eyes more than be like, oh, this is great. It's great that this exists, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just sort of, I don't know, like I could have written those lines. I would have written a less funny version, but you know, like it just didn't really, speak to me in any way that I haven't heard already. Yeah.
Right.
But yes, that is something I undoubtedly agree with.
Okay. nothing about social media or culture or celebrity that, I mean, this movie does spend some time on it. It really didn't do anything for you in those, with those themes?
I mean, it didn't, like, it wasn't, that's the thing, like, there's nothing in this movie that I was like, this is terrible. It's just there's a lot of things that I think don't add up to a really strong whole. And, I mean, it's again that sort of old man yelling type of thing. There is a scene in this movie where a daughter explains to her father how social media works, you know, like, and that is, I feel, perhaps a mirroring of something that actually happened in the writing process, of the filmmaker's daughters explaining to them how social media works. So yeah, again, it's like, it's a thing that they felt needed, was definitely a part of this world and needed to be addressed, but again, wasn't addressed in, I think, any sort of new, interesting way.
Right. Like, mm-hmm. if they said to themselves, we're going to make a movie about actors and celebrity and, you know, contemporary film and pop culture, we can't not say Twitter. So yeah. Plug that in there, but we don't really have anything to say about it.
Yeah, exactly.
The scene where he gets locked out of one of the previews and kind of has to go through Times Square, mm-hmm. and, you know, goes viral or whatever.
he walks through Times Square, stops off for a quick pack of virality at the corner store.
Yeah. yeah, a little bit of viral for you. that and the time Mike Shiner? Ed Norton?
Yep.
Gets a boner on stage is really, until the very end of the movie, one of the few times that we see kind of any audience reaction to what's going on. Mm-hmm. And other than Tabitha the critic speaking very bluntly and directly to Reagan or Mike Shiner, mm-hmm. Kind of the only real review, the only real public reaction to what's going on.
Yeah, well, we get
just like dicks and nakedness is funny, and like no one else, like no one appreciates real art.
Yeah, maybe, but I don't think. Yeah, maybe a little bit. But we do also get the Paul LaPelle moment. So we get Reagan interacting with one of his fans. And being very loved at that time by the woman in the bar. And yeah, I don't know. I guess I don't have an opinion on that. But okay. Yeah, I don't know. And I don't think, because I mean, Tabitha is portrayed in a way that is specifically meant for her to stand out from the crowd, even at the moment where the entire crowd is standing and the camera is pointed at them. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, what's Tabitha's function, though? Are we supposed to see her as the like, because this movie seems to really romanticize theater, and you know, it's like the yin and yang of performance is that theater is legitimate and films are cartoons and pornography.
Yeah, but I think I think what the subtitle is about, the title of Tabitha's review at the end of the film, is that
which is.
Or the unexpected virtue of ignorance.
Okay.
Yeah. Is about the fact that she, because her review of the play ends up being very positive. A big part of the fact that she was able to feel that positively about the play was that she never expected anything out of Reagan, you know, and that sort of idea of her being ignorant of the fact that. Good things can come from low culture, basically. And I think that the end point of art that this movie tries to make about art is that there can be high moments in what this movie often calls pornography, like you said, like superhero movies. There can be high points, and there can also be very low points, and there can also be very low points on stage. You know, it's not like there's every performance on Broadway is a good performance, you know, it's just sort of, it's like anything else. Like there are some good moments and some bad moments. And just because, the form changes doesn't mean it's necessarily bad.
Yeah. So what do we make of the final performance then? Cause we've kind of touched on it. The, fake or attempted suicide, shooting his nose off, mm-hmm. and Tabitha appreciating it.
Well, I mean, he bled for the theater, I guess. That's probably what she appreciated, right?
Yeah. She kind of says so much in her review.
Yeah. I think the thing was that since he was willing to go that far with it, the idea is that the emotions in Inner's performance up to that point were so human and raw, right? That it sort of added an element to his performance. And I think that's partially what she enjoyed. And then also the fact that he shot off his nose, you know, it really, really puts an exclamation point on the emotion of the whole thing.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Mike Shiner. why is he not just Edward Norton? Because this movie does barely exist in an alternate reality. Like, as you said, we have like Iron Man exists and Fassbender and all these, you know, real things from pop culture do exist. Mm-hmm. Why is Ed Norton playing Ed Norton but not named Ed Norton?
I don't know. Couldn't you say the same thing about Reagan?
Yes, 100%.
I think it then sort of becomes, I mean, at least at this point of their career, because like if you put Edward Norton playing himself next to Zach Galifianakis playing whatever Zach Galifianakis' character's name, it's just so it starts to lead the audience to ask, well, I mean, why is he playing himself and he's not playing himself, sort of thing. I think it's just if the character was really written to be Edward Norton, then I think they would have just changed the name to make it less confusing to the audience. Yeah.
Whoa, Birdman, Batman. I just pieced that together.
I mean, I'm still piecing it together, even after you said that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a good point.
Is Mike Shiner an anagram for the Incredible Hulk as well?
I don't think that's right.
The Incredible Hulk before Ruffalo.
Yeah. I'll have to work on that anagram after the podcast.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I bet you won't get back to me.
Yeah, because thinking about Michael Keaton's career, obviously, as you are very clearly led to do in mm-hmm. this movie, he did make a movie a few years ago that he directed.
Yes. What is it? The Merry Men or something?
The Merry Gentleman.
The Merry Gentleman, sorry.
Yeah, which is about a woman. I have not seen this movie, but I researched it briefly. It's starring and directed by Michael Keaton, as I said. And the plot is a woman leaves an abusive relationship to begin a new life in a new city, where she forms an unlikely and ironic relationship with a suicidal hitman, which is Michael Keaton.
Doesn't sound merry at all.
No, it doesn't. But it does sound like you know, like what this Raymond Carver play is to Reagan's in this movie. No.
Yes. Yeah. I definitely hear some similarities. But yes.
Yeah, and like
we're being very Tabitha right now, judging Michael Keaton's work without having seen it.
No, I know. In labeling it so much. And licking so many homeless assholes.
I've licked like five since we started recording.
No, but it's... Again, we have spent so much time speaking fairly negatively about this movie, which I legitimately did enjoy more than I'm making it sound. It just seems like it really wants to have it both ways. Like, this movie... It really kind of... It posits this Reagan's character as being, you know, kind of pretentious and, you know, really down on his luck and having this kind of one, you know, last ditch effort to retain some gain some credibility because he's kind of just a, you know, pop culture actor, not like a serious theater person like Mike Shiner is. Mm-hmm. This movie is kind of like The Merry Gentleman. It was, you know, what Michael Keaton did when 20 years after the fact, he wasn't nearly as famous and wanted to be seen as a legitimate actor and come, you know, get some prominence in Hollywood or New York or in the arts community altogether. Mm-hmm. But it also kind of seems like that's not legitimate. And what this Riggins character is doing is very desperate and self-serving. And I think this movie really talks about how much it values true art and creativity and, mm-hmm. you know, the bravery of these artists and things like that. But then also doesn't talk about cinema in a way that it seems like you could ever achieve that. Do you know what I mean? Like, does that make any sense?
Yes. Yes. But I think the core of the movie is sort of finding out that I think the idea is that Riggin is doing this play to shut the voices up in his head that tell him that he's never done anything good, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why at the end of the movie, just before whatever he does going out that window, which, by the way, barf, it's him leaving that voice behind. Like, he's finally done something that he feels will be able to make that voice go away. And I think what this movie says, and something I enjoy about this movie quite a bit, is that does a lot of talking about how you're trying to reach some sort of higher truth by creating art, but really all you're trying to do is quiet that voice in your head that tells you you aren't shit, you know, like and that's what I think is the most interesting part about this movie, because that's one of the things that this movie never really talks too much about. It's sort of implied, and I like that. I like that a lot. And I think one of my favorite moments in the movie comes the first time Mike Shiner and Emma Stone's character, whose name I forget, are standing
Sam.
Okay, are standing on the I don't know, I guess balcony of this theater or outside, where they're not quite on the roof of the theater, but you know what I mean. Yeah. And they're having that conversation about truth or dare, and Mike Shiner keeps saying truth, and she says, why don't you ever pick dare? He says, the truth is always interesting. And I think that's kind of an interesting line, because we sort of get this idea that facts and thought are more interesting than actually like acting on something. And I think that sort of ties into the whole superhero versus play sort of thing. Like, plays are generally wordier than the most recent Captain America film, and there's a lot more like physical movement in this Captain America film than on the play, where you have to focus on the words more, and it's just more thought than action. And I think this movie really strongly speaks about the positive aspects of thinking, and as well as the negative aspects of thinking, and that thinking too much about your own life will kind of drive you crazy, and then the only way you can ignore it is by finally doing what the voice inside your head says you could never do. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's Bird, like, you don't go back to Birdman 4, you actually give a good performance on the stage.
Yeah. Right. And so would you say this is, I know you feel the window thing, as you said, Barf, but not qualitatively speaking, but would you say this is a happy ending, kind of Riggins learned something? Like, it sounds like you're saying he feels like he's validated as an artist now, he's done something worthwhile, that he's kind of been true to himself in a way that your heroes are supposed to be true, and it worked out positively.
Yes, I definitely agree this movie is supposed to be seen as having a happy ending.
Okay. Would you say that happy ending is a bit contradictory, or sends a bit of a bad message insofar as...
To kids?
Yeah.
Are you worried about what the kids are learning from this film?
No, I just mean, like, I mean, to go back to maybe this movie trying to do too much or trying to have things both ways. It seems like a very... like, Riggins doesn't seem to be a very good person or a very good character.
I mean, he throws a wife or a knife at his ex-wife, you know, like, not in the film, but we hear the story. He's done some very shitty things, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, you can have bad things in your past, and the version of you presented in a film can still be what we're supposed to sympathize with or like or relate to. I just mean he seems to be really just self-interested, and
oh, definitely.
not good to people around him. And I just have a hard time reconciling that with the positivity I think we're really supposed to take. Like, we have his daughter looking up at him at the end or whatever. we'll go with the reading that he flies because he has these superpowers now that he realizes who he really is and has these artistic wings.
He's up there with the birds now.
Exactly. It just seems like he got off a little easy for being an asshole for a really long time. And
yeah,
I'm just having a hard time kind of piecing together this very kind of pessimistic picture of this guy and then this transition where everything's okay now.
Exactly.
And I know a lot of movies, you know, you struggle and then things become good and that's a character arc. But this just seems to be missing the validate. Like, he just has a sad talk with his daughter and it gets a good review and everything's okay.
Yes, I agree. He's incredibly self-interested. And that's sort of why the flaw, I think, that this movie, or a flaw that this movie has, is that it's not just Reagan's perspective, because I feel like that ending would be stronger if we never really have scenes that Reagan isn't in, right? Because then it would be more about his journey as opposed to trying to show us this sort of like this world that we all exist within, you know, whereas the end of the movie really only strongly concerns Reagan. Like, his best friend is very happy. Amy Ryan is happy he's not dead. Emma Stone is also happy he's not dead. But yeah, it is a very self-interested ending, and that's sort of where I think a lot of the other parts of the narrative really don't come together, just because it's such a self-interested character with such a self-interested ending. You know, like, once he gets his moment of transcendence, he's up with the birds and the movie's over, you know, and then we just see his daughter being like, oh, I'm so happy for you. Okay.
Yeah, this the meandering camera that we've been talking about, that so many people have been talking about as kind of the thing about this movie. It's interesting when they go to all these people and, you know, Reagan's isn't there, and the conversation doesn't necessarily concern him, but we kind of have this whole world and the actors and the critic and his Galifianakis, the lawyer producer or whatever. That's not that funny.
I thought when he was explaining that he's the lawyer and producer and best friend, I thought that was kind of funny.
Okay. It was cool, and it was kind of this like three-dimensional world in more than one sense. Like, I love the camera going from like building to building and things like that. Like, there's some really, really cool things there about this whole world, and then things really just kind of fall off near the end, and it really becomes all about Reagan. And, you know, of course this movie is primarily about him, but
it's also about the unexpected virtue of ignorance, right?
Yeah. No, it's not just because I think Edward Norton's good, but I think those scenes were really strong. Like, some of the Reagan and Shiner just discussing how to perform and what to do with this piece of dialogue. I thought that was some really strong stuff. And then it just kind of, as the movie went on, just shedded the most interesting things. And then kind of quickly wraps up with this unsatisfactory end.
Well, and Shiner is, through so much of this movie, is meant to be sort of a younger version of Reagan, like where Reagan wishes he had gone with his career, right?
Yeah, this very respected theater actor.
Yeah, exactly. Who has his own problems, but we never really find out what his ending is, because yeah, he's a character not named Reagan that's in this film.
Yeah, and he even steals Reagan's like origin story at one point about how important Raymond Carver is and how that made him become an actor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yes, I agree. It's a movie with a lot of ideas that don't come together because it kind of only ends up focusing on Reagan at the end. Yeah, and I think that kind of speaks to the core problem with this movie. It has a lot of ideas about what it wants to be, but sort of isn't able to sort of execute in this way that sort of makes it, makes it stand out from the pack. Like, it sort of places itself in this type of film by being this
this weird meta story and casting actors playing people that are kind of like themselves and having those actors being very famous. And so just by doing that, it's sort of placing itself in that whole like opening night of a film festival category, you know?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
this very high-minded sort of American film. And it reminded me actually of like Big Crit is a rapper who just put out an album, and Kendrick Lamar has also recently put out a single, and they're both kind of in the same class of rapper. They're both very talented, I think, and both kind of exist on the highest plateau of modern like commercial rap music. But Big Crit just seems to be making the same song over and over again because he knows that that's what he's supposed to do. Whereas Kendrick Lamar, despite I think having the same attention or intentions as Big Crit, which is to make really good musical rap music with well-written lyrics and all that, actually makes songs that surprise you. Like his latest single, when it came out, it didn't sound like a Kendrick Lamar song from his previous record. Whereas all 17 songs on Big Crit's new record sound like all 14 songs from Big Crit's last record. And I feel like Birdman is kind of like a Big Crit record in that way. You know, it's just sort of, it knows the place that it's in, but it doesn't know how to sort of transcend that. It doesn't know how to get up to the birds. You know, it's at the end of Birdman, it's still dealing with its inner voice, I think, or it should be at least, whether or not the filmmakers are willing to accept that.
Yeah, and between the cinematography you discussed and the score, which, you know, is so present, it's a very immersive movie. Like, the lack of cuts really get you in there. Some very good performances as well, as we said. Like, I felt really engaged with this movie for a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, it just seems like there's all these ideas floating around that never get nailed down and never have anything that interesting said about it. And it tackles so many themes and never tackles them to the ground. Like, it, they really get away from the movie, I feel. And
it thinks it's playing two-hand touch, but it's really playing tackle.
Yeah, like, it seems like it really wants to be a big boy movie. And it has all those things that you said, like, these famous actors playing people like themselves. It has this, you know, kind of a dream role for someone like Michael Keaton. You know, it's this kind of career retrospective, and it's also about, you know, what it is to be where you are in your career right now and how that's can be pretty depressing and difficult. Like, it has like so many of these really good ideas on paper, and then technically, as I said, the music and the cinematography and performances I think are fantastic as well at times, and then it just never as you said, it's really just never able to transcend that. And I wouldn't discourage anyone from seeing this movie. Like, I think it has, as I said, some very, very funny parts, some great performances, some very impressive technical craftsmanship. But definitely, let's go with Flies Too Close to the Sun. That's a closing bird pun.
Yeah, I think a big problem with this movie is that since it centers so much about art and so much of the film just nakedly talks about art, we have to sort of see it as conscious of its own place in the art world, you know? And since it's talking about wanting to be a higher piece of art than most other pieces of art, we have to see it as aiming for that, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it sort of it really kind of asks us to look at it this way, like in a kind of a blatant way. And then it just isn't able to back it up, you know? And like you said, it's just a lot of wonderful individual pieces that don't totally come together. There's just something missing. And yeah, and I think maybe the subtitle, The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, isn't so bad, because maybe if we had been ignorant about all of these things, we would have loved this film, you know?
Maybe.
Yeah. You know? And maybe that's the real closing of the film, you know? We're just too dumb to get it. Or sorry, we're just too smart to get it. That's it.
With massive eyeballs looking at the window.
So thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. We'll be off next week. I think we'll probably just rerun our episode on The Graduate from a couple years ago, because like I mentioned, Mike Nichols died today, and The Graduate is The Graduate, so it's totally worth talking about again. But yeah, we'll be off next week, but look for our Graduate podcast, and we'll be back in a couple weeks.
We have plenty of content. We're just doing this out of respect for Mike Nichols.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Man. And be sure to check back next week, or don't if you are too offended. Anyway, bye.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.